Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak to Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress Action Fund about the breaking story, this weird story of James Comey, FBI Director James Comey, dropped on the election on Friday. Then we'll be joined by EJ Graff. EJ is the managing editor of the Monkey Cage at the Washington Post. And she's a journalist and author. She writes all over the place. And she was the lead researcher on a report by PEN America about the campus free speech wars. They are not what you expect them to be, or her conclusions were not what you might expect them to be. And finally, we'll be speaking to Rick Perlstein about Trump and the future of the Republican Party. But first, I want to say a few words about the Podesta leaks, about all these news, these breaking news things that are happening late in the election, the hacked emails from Clinton campaign manager John Podesta that WikiLeaks is dribbling out, and to a degree, this story with James Comey as well. But I don't really want to talk about these stories themselves. And we're not talking about these stories themselves, because how many people are going to slog through thousands of mostly boring emails on the WikiLeaks piece? The James Comey story, the latest revelation, we don't really know anything. So we're talking about people's takes on these stories. We're talking about the selection of emails that that journalists who have dug through the pile have published pieces about. We're talking about what journalists who've dug through the pile are choosing to tweet out with perhaps with a snarky comment. And that means that our view of what these leaks reveal is really dependent on who we read and who we trust. There are disparate views at different outlets and between different writers. And increasingly, we tend to seek out information from sources that confirm our previously held beliefs, right? A lot of people get their news media from their news from social media, from Facebook, meaning they're likely to see stuff that like-minded people share. We're living in these kind of bubbles. This is all well understood between left and right. You know, the conservative and liberal media sources could be reporting from different galaxies. Everybody understands that. But here we see a similar divide in the kind of left of center media. If you read, I don't know, The Intercept or the International Business Times, or follow certain people on Twitter, you'll probably think that Podesta's emails reveal an abundance of ethical violations and ideological compromises, and that they prove that Hillary Clinton is venal and corrupt. But if you read outlets like Talking Points Memo or Vox, you'll probably conclude that they only reveal the rough and tumble reality of any modern political campaign. You know, staffers tend to be cynical. They talk smack about their opponents. They work their allies. They schmooze reporters. They do damage control. They prepare lines of attack to use against their opponents. All of that stuff, you know, is stuff that is somewhat typical of a campaign. But how you're viewing that depends on the lens through which you are viewing it. So what is the point here? The point is that these things are not having a lot of effect on the election, because if you, whatever you thought about Hillary Clinton and her campaign before these leaks, before the Comey story broke, is probably what you'll think about her campaign afterwards, right? The emails viewed through the lens of our polarized media only go to confirm one's priors. So, you know, this is the place that we're at. We're a very polarized society. People are on, they have taken sides, and they are listening to other people who are on their side. They are not listening to people who are on the other side. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then come right back with Ian Millhiser to get the scoop on this Comey revelation. Stay tuned.
Like a shot of whiskey in a troubled man's hands. She numbs the pain, but the pain demands another shot of something, so he keeps coming back. And his his hands, they tremble as he brings her to his lips. She shuts her eyes as she grinds her hips. And a long train whistle blows way down the line. Buzzing around the bed, the smell of sex and a cigarette. She tries to hide the tears upon her face. He's lying there, just pretends to sleep, hoping she'll leave before he has to speak. And a long train whistle blows way down the line. She wants to jump that train, leave this life behind. He wants to jump that train, leave this life behind. They just lie right there, listening to that whistle whine.
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined now by Ian Millhiser. Ian is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. He's also an excellent writer and an excellent legal analyst. You should check out everything that he writes on Think Progress and elsewhere. Ian, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
I appreciate you jumping in at the last moment. This is a breaking news story, the so-called October surprise. James Comey, tell me what your take is on the letter that he sent to Congress today.
I mean, it is rare you see a story that causes so much whiplash in the news media. So the initial headlines were explosive. So what happened here is the FBI Director James Comey sent a letter to several Republican congressional committee chairs saying actually very little about the investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server. Jason Chaffetz, who is one of those Republican chairs, immediately blasted it out saying, oh my God, they're reopening the investigation. And that was the initial spin that, wow, like the FBI found something new and they're looking into this again and maybe she'll be indicted. And with each subsequent revelation, it has turned out that there was less going on here than what we previously thought. So what the letter actually says is that the FBI discovered new emails, and so they're going to look at those emails, and they're going to see if there's any classified information in there. And that's it. So nothing particularly explosive. And, you know, like I said, there's been more revelations that have trickled out, which suggests that it is not very likely there's going to be anything really interesting at all in those emails.
Now, Comey's been taking a lot of heat from, well, at least on social media for mm-hmm. the nature of this letter. Was he required to send something to Congress?
So that is unclear. Newsweek reported that, that the reason why he sent this letter when he did is because he testified to Congress that they were done looking at the emails, and he felt like he had a responsibility to immediately inform Congress once they found these new emails and figured that they had to read them. I've had a friend of mine who was a fairly senior DOJ official says that he doesn't think that Newsweek is correct about that. But in any event, it appears that Comey thought that he had some sort of obligation, and that's why he decided to drop this very inflammatory, if not very informative, letter 11 days before an election.
Is there any universe in which he wouldn't know what kind of impact this would have? I mean, it's the vagueness of the letter that's the problem, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, if he felt that he had some sort of obligation, you know, I'm not going to question his interpretation of the law. But it looks like this is a very small deal. I mean, what we know is we know that none of the emails that were discovered were sent by Hillary Clinton. We know they were not on, they were not found on her server. We know that the neither Clinton nor the Clinton campaign did anything to cover these emails up. And we also know the New York Times is reporting that they apparently uncovered them during an investigation into former Congressman Anthony Weiner, the sexting guy, because Weiner, of course, was used to be married to Huma Abedin, who is one of Hillary Clinton's top aides. So, I mean, for all we know, it could be that these new emails are just, you know, Hillary Clinton sent an email to Weiner and to Abedin congratulating them on their anniversary, but because they originated from her private server, the FBI has to take a look at them because that's the scope of their mandate.
The New York Times reports that the FBI is investigating illicit text messages that Mr. Weiner sent to a 15-year-old girl.
North Carolina.
This is the
most 2016 story. I mean, like, everything
snakes on a plane,
here.
Man. Snakes on a plane. Let me ask you this. Is Anthony Weiner's continued existence on this planet, does that disprove the Clinton kill list?
I mean, certainly everything about this disproves the notion that anything is rigged. I mean, you know, what you have is you have this story which, you know, like I said, based on all the information we know, looks like it's a really small deal. It was released in the most inflammatory way possible. I mean, like, something like 10 minutes after the story broke, Donald Trump was giving was at a rally, and the people at the rally were cheering him on as he was talking about, ha, they got Hillary Clinton now, they're reopening this thing. And, you know, like I said, as it turns out, that doesn't seem to be the case. You know, what seems to be the case, I mean, what we have always known is that government officials are allowed to delete personal emails for the same reason that I'm allowed to delete personal emails. And Hillary Clinton said a while back that the emails she was turning over were emails related to her government work and not her personal emails. So she deleted things, you know, the example she gave is she deleted emails about her yoga classes. Now, it's possible that, you know, because she didn't just have a professional relationship, she had a personal relationship with Weiner and Abedin, that she exchanged personal emails with them. And so that could be a possible explanation for why these new emails that were sent from Hillary Clinton's private email account might have suddenly turned up, because in the process of investigating Anthony Weiner, they found emails unrelated to her job as Secretary of State. And now they're going to look at them. They're going to see if there's anything classified in them. I think there's a high likelihood that there's not anything classified in them, but who knows? And then chances are that they'll be done with this and we'll be in the same position we thought we were in 24 hours ago.
And how long until we find out more information about this? I mean, is this something that's going to just kind of drag on through Election Day, or do you think that we're going to have a better sense of what the story means before then?
I mean, this could drag on through like much of the Clinton presidency. I mean, the letter ends with this ominous line: although the FBI cannot yet assess whether or not the material may be significant, I cannot predict how long it will take us to complete this additional work.
What an election.
So just what we thought we could finally put the damn email story to bed, you know, this comes up and here we are.
Ian Millhiser, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to jump in there at the last minute and get us up to speed on this story. I really do appreciate it.
All right, sure thing.
Folks, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back.
If I had to lose a mind, if I had to touch feeling, I would lose my soul. I don't have to think,
have to do it. The results are always perfect, but that's all the news. Would you like to hear my voice sprinkled with emotion? When it hit your birth, I can't see the end of me. My whole expanse I cannot see. Formulate affinity stored deep inside. Lose a mind, I had to touch feeling. I would lose my soul the way I do. I don't have to think, I only have to do it. The results are always perfect, but that's old news. Would you like to hear my voice? Sprinkled with emotion, invented at your birth. I can't see the end of me. My own expanse I cannot see. Formulate infinity stored deep inside me.
Welcome back. I'm joined now by EJ Graff. EJ is a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University, and her stuff is published literally everywhere. Is that true, EJ? Is there no place on earth where you haven't been published?
I've missed a couple of outlets. I'm the managing editor at the Monkey Cage at the Washington Post.
And we love the Monkey Cage. John Sides has been on the show many times. Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we've heard a lot of stories lately about free speech issues on college campuses. We've heard kind of dark tales of young Uber PC kids run amok. EJ was a senior researcher on a report recently released by PEN America. It's called And Campus for All, Diversity, Inclusion, and Freedom of Speech at U.S. Universities. And listeners can read it for themselves. It's at pen.org. It's got way too much detail for us to cover in this amount of time, so I urge you to do so. EJ, I want to look at some of the specific cases that are highlighted in the report, but before we zoom in, can you give us just a general sense of what you expected to find when you went into this project based on kind of, you know, reading these accounts in the media and how your views changed as you dug into the issue?
I expected to find what we have been reading about, coddled, hypersensitive, young people who wanted to live in padded rooms and were using pacifiers, you know, protected from discomfort. And I did not find that at all. I was really shocked that, and you'd think a reporter wouldn't be shocked by this anymore, but over and over, what I found was extremely different from how it had been portrayed. I found serious activists who were very interested in using speech to challenge speech. And they might have used the political process within their universities a little vigorously. They might have shouted some. But overall, they were not shrinking from contact with other people, with disagreement, they were confronting it.
Now, I noticed that stories about students, mostly on the left, shouting down speakers they disagree with or whatever, they seem to get a lot of promotion in the media, and especially in the conservative media. Do you have any sense of why adults who aren't college professors, people without an attachment to the academy, why do we seem so interested in what the kids are doing these days? And why is this a regular beat at outlets like The Daily Caller and Breitbart? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, I don't think I can weigh in on that. I know there are a number of people who have theories about it, and I am. That's not really where I spent my research time. What I can say is that with the 24-hour-a-day news media, everybody has to be commenting on something at all times, right? Not just the cable news that took off at a certain period, but news outlets online have to be filling their pages at all hours of the day. And I think in some cases it's much easier to link to something apparently outrageous at Yale than it is to have to be constantly reporting nuance. You can turn something out much faster if you link to something that's easily commented on.
And a lot of the coverage is kind of scornful coverage about what the report calls the new language of harm. So these are the trigger warnings, the idea of having safe spaces, microaggressions. And you say we're not coddling students, or these students don't demand to be coddled. What is your view of these kind of new words? And they're, for us olds, they are a little bit off-putting, right?
Oh, completely, completely. But that's the function of a genuinely new generation of in politics, right, is to discomfort the elders. That's kind of their job. What struck me, really, and I want to be very clear that I don't speak for Penn. I came away with my own thoughts and my own impressions, and I contributed my research to their report, but their conclusions and their recommendations are their own. And my thoughts and feelings are my own. I did come up with that term, though, the new language of harm, because that's what came to me as I was doing the background reading, is that they really were trying to, there is a generation, it's not just the students, right? Some these terms I could talk about each one specifically, but they came from professors or activists of previous generations. They've just been taken up and put to work in new ways by the young people. But what they struck me as doing is articulating a kind of harm that it was just difficult to talk about before. Like, when feminists invented the concept of marital rape, that sounded crazy to people, right? Because if a man married a woman, then that was it. She was his. So once you start calling it something, people have to grapple with it as a concept, or domestic violence. I think what they're talking about are usually things that are actually harmful, and the way they have been portrayed has been greatly exaggerated. I'm not going to say that there aren't, let me take back all the negatives. There surely are some of them out there who are extremists, and sure, they're always right and not thoughtful at all about what they're saying, but that's true anytime, any place, in any large demographic group or
and also we're talking
group.
About young people, right? And
right,
young people
right.
are young people.
Oh my God, they're such young people. Yeah. No, I mean, they are. And in a way, that's why it's easy to portray them badly. I mean, I was very struck by the fact that in a few cases, a couple of moments of meltdown got caught on cell phone video. I mean, if someone had been videoing me when I was 18 and angry about something in politics, I would have no life right now. I mean, I just don't know anyone who wasn't intemperate at some point in their college years if they had some political passions. So they...
And if they didn't have any political passions, they might be part of a frat that drank 8,000 beers or swallowed goldfish.
Right.
I mean,
this article, we're talking about politics.
No, I know, but I'm just saying that, you know, we are talking about young people, and young people are immature. I mean, that it's just inherent to being young. As you say, if I were recorded when I was 18, oh my God. I mean,
oh my God. We all say that, right? Oh my God.
I've done the stupid. I was such a moron when I was a young. Okay. So go ahead.
You
get the point,
so,
right?
I wrote things for the student paper that I am so grateful can never be found. I don't think they're even in microfilm somewhere. But, you know, these kids are, as 18-year-olds, 19, 20, 21-year-olds are, 100% sure they're absolutely right about everything, and other people just don't see it. And a lot of the things that they are talking about are serious, and that it's just easy to caricature.
Let me take one of these, safe spaces. You know, it's integral to a good education. You have to be exposed to ideas with which you disagree, even vehemently, ideas that are potentially disturbing, right? I mean, I took a class on the Holocaust. I had to look at these extraordinary images that are seared into my brain, and I'm glad I took that class. How do you kind of reconcile the idea of a safe space in a classroom with the need to be exposed to...
Well, wait a minute. You said a safe space in a classroom. I didn't hear anybody talk about safe space in a classroom.
Okay.
Right? I mean, a safe space is a retreat space, right? That's like your weekly LGBT meeting where you can be pretty sure no one's going to beat you up for looking too much like a boy if you're a girl, right? So a safe space is a retreat space. A safe space isn't everything. You know, I didn't find people asking for everything to be safe all the time.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. Like, this new language of harm is easily caricatured if you misunderstand it. I did hear people talking about they didn't feel safe. That was one thing. In general, when I talk to the students and the faculty and the administration, they spoke pretty highly. They weren't. It's hard to generalize across too many situations. But let's take Yale for instance. At Yale, there were a group of students who had been working for a fairly significant period of time to try and get the administration, group of students of color, primarily the black students, so they're seriously working in coalition with the other students of color. And they had been trying to get the administration to grasp that they no longer wanted to be what they're calling unpaid teachers, right? If they had been brought there to be the diversity and educate the white kids about what it's like to be from a diverse background, they didn't want that to be their job, right? They wanted to be able to engage. If they wanted to engage, but they were really there for their own education, and they wanted to be able to center their own experience in themselves and in their own learning, and they felt a little bit used in having to be the one who was doing racial education for white people all the time. And they won a small victory. They got an email to go out from one of the campus centers for student life of some kind, and that's the wrong name, but it's in the accurate name is in the report, and saying to all students, Halloween is coming up, please consider your fellow students, basically. I mean, we quote it at length in the report, so you can read the rest of it if you like. But, you know, before you dress in blackface or redface or wear headdresses or whatever, just think about what those things might mean, please, to someone who comes from that background and for whom it symbolizes something different. It was a little bit clumsily worded, but it didn't say don't do it. It didn't say if you do it, we're putting you in jail. Nothing. So the students of color were pretty happy that finally they weren't the ones who had to do all the educating. You know, the administration was going to stand up for them a little bit and do some of the racial education. And then the assistant head of one of the, what they call the residential colleges, which is a sort of dorm system, I think, sent out an email saying, aren't we infantilizing the students if we're having, if we're asking the administration to speak for them? Can't students set their own social norms amongst themselves? So the students of color were furious. They just felt that she did not understand at all what they were trying to do and what they had tried so hard to do. And
now, it was Nicholas Christakis who sent out the first email, right? And then
no,
Erica,
it was Erica Christakis who sent
Erica
out the email
first, and then Nicholas got involved.
And that was her husband, so they were jointly the head of this residence, and they wouldn't speak to me, so I can't speak to their point of view. They felt pretty burned by the entire thing, which is the fact that everyone feels burned out by the social media. I think is its own, and Penn thinks that it's its own problem.
Yes, it is.
And no one really knows what to do about that yet. In any case, so they confronted her and tried to get her, and then he stepped in alongside her, tried to get them to understand their point of view. And I think years of being treated as other came to the fore, and they felt that the microaggressions, the sort of daily erosion of dignity when you're constantly made to feel other or like you don't belong there, that the Christakises really weren't grasping what they were trying to say, and they asked for them to step down, not as faculty, but as heads of the residence, because they felt, and this isn't everyone, right? I'm generalizing in order to be able to speak. On some of the students who lived in that residence said they felt unsafe there. Now, that would be the part where I think people feel differently about the use of that term, right? Safety for older people is almost 100% actual physical safety, right? Do you feel like the house is going to burn down? Do you feel like someone is going to beat you up? Do you think you're going to be attacked in the night? No, they meant they felt like the head of the residence was not someone they could turn to, and so when they were in the building, they felt that. So that might be a use of the term unsafe that I think there would be differences about.
There was a video recording that went viral and really came to define the sense. And hold on one second. Let me just say, if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with EJ Graff about the campus free speech wars. And I want to just read a couple of headlines about this before you go on. The Daily Caller: meet the privileged Yale student who shrieked at her professor. The Federalist: watch a mob of Yale students bully a professor they say hurt their feelings. Tablet: new videos show Yale betrayed itself by favoring cry bullies. I like cry bullies, by the way. And then when they stepped down, the Wall Street Journal ran a piece titled "How the Yale Halloween Vigilantes Finally Got Their Way." And lest you think this is just a narrative that's common to right-wing outlets, this is what the World Socialist website, which is the leftiest of the left, said: the campaign against Erica Nicholas Christakis has a thoroughly anti-democratic and right-wing character. There is not a whiff of racism or any other prejudice in their comments. Those leading the campaign against the Christakises are not taking up a struggle against serious injustice. They are using the incident as leverage in their pursuit of greater privilege for already privileged African and American and other minority professionals.
Oof. Yeah, well, there's so many things in there that are false. One being, there were a significant number of the African-American students are not from privileged backgrounds. They're actually the scholarship kids. So they had both the race and class gap with their fellow Yalies. So it's certainly a privilege to be there, and God knows it's not a privilege that I had. But they, you know, they were square pegs in round holes. They were trying to say, you know, let's make, if you want us here, make room for us and don't treat us as strange. So that the video of what came to be called the shrieking girl, she got death threats. She got completely doxxed. Things happened to her family. I mean, that poor young woman is scarred for life for having a tantrum. I mean, it was a tantrum. Like, she wasn't bullying Christakis, as far as I could tell. She was having a meltdown. As we were talking at the beginning of our conversation here, as college students do, you know, you come up against injustice, you see what ought to be done, you're 100% sure that you're right, and then you cannot believe that other people won't do what you know to be the right thing.
It may be your first time away from home also.
Maybe your first time away from home, and yeah, you're living with someone you just realized does not get something that is really fundamental to you. And you were led to expect that. That's what you were sold as your vision of Yale. So she's being a young adult, more on the young side than on the adult side for a few minutes. And I feel really bad for her that she was used to symbolize everybody else. But in the things that were called bullying were not the things that the student group activists as a group asked for, right? They were not using the F word. They were not, sorry, I'm a mom, so I can't say that word anymore. They were not they weren't making extreme demands. They got together as activists and released a very muted, very thoughtful, clear list of demands that wasn't unlimited. It was certainly more reasonable than some that I can remember from groups I was associated with at one point. And it doesn't seem to me that they were bullying. What they were doing was being very vocal. So it's not so much, and they made this point to me over and over, they weren't against free speech. They were using free speech to counter what they saw as a profound misunderstanding of what they were asking for.
The other context that I think is really missing here is that Yale has traditionally struggled with issues of race and racial stratification and discrimination. My mother she's attached to Yale nominally. She's a social worker who works with Yale New Haven Medical Center. And she was talking about how this was a case that really was almost a straw that broke the camel's back kind of thing. That there was much background to this that was largely absent from all the coverage. That this wasn't about this one note, right? I mean, this wasn't kids freaking out about an email. This was something that was the culmination of a lot of activism on very real issues that nobody would deny are very real issues if they were given that context.
Correct. I mean, a kid had been stopped at gunpoint, a young man, young African-American man, going to his dorm the previous year because he was confused with a burglary suspect. It was that kind of ongoing low-level racial burden that the students were talking about or asked to represent black people when they were in class. You know, what do you think of this? I can't speak for them. I will say that one thing that was very interesting, I mean, more about the entire situation is in the case studies of the report if someone wants to follow up, but one thing that was interesting to me was how difficult it was to get anybody to talk to me. I went to three different universities that had become notorious for one situation or another. One for race was Yale, one on the conflict between Jewish groups and BDS groups and questions of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia at UCLA, and one on the apparent Title IX abuses of the process of claiming sexual harassment at Northwestern, and nobody wanted to talk to me. People felt so badly burned. I just didn't. I mean, I sent out email after email after email, and in each case, it almost took. It really did take personal contacts and some very personal emails to people to get them to even agree to meet me and figure out whether I was going to misrepresent them. That's how burned students and administration felt talking about these issues.
Yeah, and that gets back to the media, the rather distorted media coverage that we were talking about. EJ, I believe we are out of time. Unfortunately, I wanted to talk to you about the UCLA case. There's so much in this report. I really recommend that listeners check it out for themselves. It's at penn.org. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Josh.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Rick Perlstein.
He was born a fool for love. What he wouldn't do for love. He's a fool for love. She was 6 and he was 7. Used to send him off to heaven when she said, "You are my sunshine." The party always liked the best when she'd tease him with a kiss and she said, "You make me happy." You fool. What he wouldn't do for love. He's a fool, a fool for love. Born a fool, you've got to follow the rule. Always a fool for love. He grew up, he didn't get much better. Tattooed underneath his sweater, L-O-V-E in blue. Seems he was never satisfied, chasing girls like butterflies, believing every word they said was true. He's a fool for love. What he wouldn't do. Once a fool, you've got to follow the rule. Always a fool for love. The last time I saw him alive, he was standing up on the bride's side, yelling his objections at the groom. The blushing bride was my best friend. She turned around and to him said, "Yes, you were my only sunshine then." You fool for love. What he wouldn't do for love. He's a fool, a fool for love.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by historian Rick Perlstein, who is the Washington Spectator's D.C. correspondent, a brilliant writer, the author of many excellent books about the American right. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Josh. Good to be here.
So let me ask you about the big news right now. We're recording this on Friday, hours after FBI Director James Comey sent a letter to Congress saying his agency would investigate some new emails. Big splash, but then there are reports that the emails in question were not from Clinton's server. They weren't from John Podesta. They weren't from Hillary Clinton. And it's not clear that they're actually reopening the investigation. Now, I don't want to put you on the spot. This is a breaking news story. But James Comey, he often gets portrayed as this kind of, you know, above the fray, bipartisan, you know, cautious, functionary. But you've written some stuff about James Comey's background that kind of sheds a different light on it. Tell me about Comey.
Well, James Comey, you know, is not some kind of angel. I mean, he's a Republican, right? He has a pretty bad record behind him in the Bush Justice Department. He was involved in the Padilla case, which was just the biggest cock up we've ever seen, and basically has kind of tortured this poor kid, Jose Padilla, to death for something that never really happened, which is this supposed involvement in
a dirty bomb.
Yeah, I don't mean tortured him to death, but he's kind of turned his brain to jello at this point. You know, he was on the board of a bank was charged with cleaning up its reputation after paying $2 billion fine for laundering drug money. You know, he was on the board of, I think it was Lockheed, you know, and he was their in-house counsel, and they really did some nasty things to a whistleblower who was reporting on some really sketchy Coast Guard contracts they were doing. And, you know, he signed off on most of the worst of Bush administration's legal abuses and very questionable interpretations of federal and international law. You know, then he intervened, what was it, when Ashcroft was, you know, on his deathbed and, you know, wouldn't sign on to the worst spying, but he, you know, signed on to everything else pretty much.
Yeah. And we're not going
to, you know, I mean, it used to be, you know, just a accepted practice of law enforcement that if something was going on that was kind of discretionary, as this does seem to be near an election day, you know, you just wait until after the election to, you know, have the appearance of propriety. Yeah, right. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. I spent last week teaching in Oklahoma, so I was hanging out with all these kids who, you know, pretty much grow up around basically where the air that you breathe is kind of saturated by Republican sources of information. And, you know, they all were absolutely certain, even the ones who were liberals, that Hillary Clinton was corrupt and a liar. Some of them are voting for her while holding their nose. Whereas I think that her voting base, it's not like they're, you know, completely, you know, in the tank for her or anything like that. But I think anyone who's been following the Clintons for any amount of time with any kind of sympathy for them knows that, you know, they have what are known as Clinton rules, that, you know, they are kind of persecuted for stuff that other people get away with in a walk. I mean, people now know, I think, at least a lot of the people who listen to this broadcast know or were reminded that the Bush administration, that would be the second Bush administration, you know, erased 30 million emails, you know, under subpoena. You know, they may not know that the first Bush administration, that's George H.W. Bush, made a deal to try to preserve their own emails privately. And in fact, they awarded the guy who did it with the executive directorship of the George H.W. Bush Library. No, I'm saying that not the George H.W. Bush Library. They made him the archivist of the United States. Basically, every Republican administration is worse than what Hillary Clinton is accused of doing. So I think, you know, I mean, in this highly, quote unquote, partisan environment, as the cliche goes, yes, I think that people have kind of separated out into their respective tribes. And I don't think this will change too many minds.
And those tribes consume different media. We've self-sorted on social media, so we're seeing things that are shared by like-minded people, et cetera, et cetera. Now, let me shift gears a little bit. There are ominous rumblings about a civil war breaking out within the conservative coalition if, as seems somewhat likely, Trump loses badly in a week and a half. Before this, the conventional wisdom was that the GOP...
There was a piece in the New York Times yesterday about rumblings of a civil war, literally, that supporters of Donald Trump have promised to basically go to the mattresses if their guy doesn't win. You know, they quoted one guy saying it would lead to another revolutionary war. People are going to march in the capitals. They're going to do whatever needs to be done to get her out of office. So anyway...
Do you take those things seriously? I mean, how seriously do you take them?
Very seriously. My father-in-law, you know, escaped Nazi Germany when he was 10 years old. So I think he has a pretty good antenna for these kinds of things. And, you know, he takes it very seriously. These are the guys with guns. They don't believe that Democrats, let alone liberals, are legitimate as you know, partners in governing the country. And there's a guy whose every word they take as holy writ, who's basically telling them that our institutions are amount to a conspiracy to deprive them of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I don't think they're going to go away quietly.
I don't think that they're going to go away quietly, but I believe, and maybe I'm Pollyannish about this, I believe that the majority of them are venting on social media. They are verbally revolutionary in a way that is not quite the same as actually picking up a gun and going and taking violent action. Of course, we have people who are unstable, but that number of people is going to be a constant, more or less constant.
They're pretty, let's say at the very least, it's a pretty strong constituency for a Republican Party that is absolutely determined to do what they did with Obama, which is delegitimize her presidency through politics.
Yes, for sure. That's not a question. And let me ask you this. So until recently, there was this kind of widespread belief that if Trump lost, the party or most of the Republican coalition would write it off as an anomaly, as a Trump thing, blame his loss on his heterodox views on trade and whatnot, and go on to nominate, you know, Ted Cruz in 2020. But now more and more people are saying, no, there's no putting the toothpaste back into the tube. What happens after Trump with the Republican coalition?
I think that, yeah, the Ted Cruz's and the Marco Rubio's are going to try and hit the reset button. And, you know, there's a pretty strong precedent within the conservative tradition of doing so. They can say he wasn't a conservative. I've said before that in the conservative mind, conservatism never fails. It has only failed, right? But, you know, I mean, if George W. Bush, you know, tried to advance comprehensive immigration reform and basically kicked up a hornet's nest of people calling, you know, spurred on by talk radio, calling their senators and congressmen with such anger that he had to pull the bill. Imagine what things are going to be like, you know, 15 years later.
Yeah.
You know, on these issues like immigration, on these issues like trade, you know, on these issues like the legitimacy of Democrats as a governing partner. And, you know, it's going to be like Tea Party 2010 all over again. I think that the half-life of Republican leadership is very short these days because, you know, I think it was pretty plain to see in, you know, the last few years that Republican incumbents, there was nothing they could do to feed the volcano, right? Who was you know, the Republican leader who, you know, lost in his primary? And I'm a little fuzzy right now.
Eric Cantor.
Right, of course, Eric Cantor. And as I like to put it, I use the metaphor of feeding the volcano. You know, John Chait had a really eloquent way of putting this, that they thought that this was all about policy, right? And if they kind of made, if they fed the Tea Party the policy initiatives they wanted, that they would, you know, be sated. But obviously they weren't. It was all about the revolution devouring its children. And any kind of mature, stable Republican coalition would have to deal with that problem. But they can't deal with that problem. There are more and more people who aren't even seeing their own representatives in Washington as legitimate. They continue to overpromise. And, you know, Donald Trump is the greatest overpromiser of all. He promises, you know, basically the same thing fascists always promise, which is this return to some pristine world that never was, this redemption through action, purgation. And when people realize they're had, they're not going to, you know, sort of reflect in the light of day that maybe they should calm down and become procedural liberals. They're going to look for heads.
And this is a really key point. The Republican Party created this anger by promising that if they were given control of one chamber of Congress, they could undo Obamacare and they could push back on all sorts of, you know, get rid of the you know, Dodd-Frank and overturn the entire agenda of this president when you can't do that, when you can control only one chamber of Congress. And, you know, they said it again and again and again and again. They held 57 votes to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And in the meantime, these people were feeling, you know, Dolchstoss. They were stabbed in the back.
Stabbed in the back, yeah. And, you know, even if Donald Trump, by some, you know, horrible dystopian miracle, won, it would be even worse. You know, Richard Nixon liked to tell a story. He was riding in a helicopter, you know, Marine II, right after his inauguration. He saw some ugly Quonset huts in the mall. And he said, get rid of those. Those are really nasty. They're really kind of, you know, spoiling this glorious American vista. And he rode the same helicopter 4 years later. And he said, those Quonset huts are still there. Jesus, Lyndon Johnson used to say, you know, the only people who listen to what I have to say, you know, are the generals, right? I mean, executive power itself isn't even all that it's cracked up to be, even if you're of an authoritarian mindset like Donald Trump. You know, so basically what we have is this entire population of people that has been completely manipulated by their leaders in a way that kind of twists them around these kind of standards that can't possibly be met. Civic life has almost become impossible. Yet we have to, you know, go on with the country and live together and govern together.
Now, what do you make of reports that Trump is building this alt-right army, this huge mailing list? There's talk of Trump TV, and there have been some reports that suggest that he wants to be a major kind of power player within the GOP, shape its agenda for years to come. Is this a hostile takeover by this ethno-nationalist rump of the party? And does Trump have the competence and focus to follow through on it? He's had so many kind of half-baked operations that ended up in failure, the Trump Air and Trump Stakes. Is there any reason to think that this effort might be different?
Well, Trump's architect, the architect of Trump Tower, Dare Scott, in this wonderful movie, this wonderful thing you can see on YouTube called Trump the Movie, which they made in the early 90s, and Trump threatened to sue them, so you can only they only were able to kind of release it a year ago. And by the way, it showed everything you needed to know about Trump. So it's completely scandalous that people didn't see this coming if they, you know, the information was there. But Dare Scott said to understand any claim that Trump makes, you have to divide it in half and then divide it again by four. And then you have something approaching the truth. Right? So obviously he doesn't have the administrative capacity to do this. The structures aren't there to build a cable TV empire because the carriage is just too expensive and it just isn't there. And all the bandwidth is already filled. As far as the internet, no one has ever made this business model work. And, you know, are these kind of brats who are hanging out, you know, saying nasty things on the internet, are they the kind of people who, you know, even have the money to throw around to make a prospect like this realistic? I think that the idea of Trump having the patience to do what Weber called the slow boring of hard boards, that's the definition of politics, right, is pretty much inconceivable. He's already said, you know, if he loses, it was a waste of time. So I just don't think he has what it takes. He's no Walter Reuther, you know, he's no Phyllis Schlafly, these happy warriors who keep on drilling and drilling and drilling against the odds for decades at a time.
The other thing is that he doesn't have a coherent ideological perspective to advance in the way that some of those happy warriors of the right did in the 1950s. Rick, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, I hope I said something useful.
You always do. Smart man.
Bye-bye.
I'd also like to thank Ian Milheiser and EJ Graff. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. Of course, I'd like to thank Digby, Heather Parton, and the folks at Crooks and Liars for letting me host the show there. I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
They're in need and there was good. There in the garden where the tree of life stood. There the snake was, there was pain.
There the snake was, there was pain.
And we're trying to get back to the garden again.